Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Alright, y'all. So, it's my show. I'm Scott. This is the show. I keep saying that. Thanks for tuning in. ScottHorton.org is my website. Did I mention to you that I've created a new division, a new department on ScottHorton.org, ScottHorton.org/documentaries. And I haven't made any documentaries or anything. It's just links to documentaries that I've seen before and liked. And thought, well, maybe you would like them too. So that's at ScottHorton.org/documentaries. Warning, there may be tamale burps coming up in the show today. But you've been warned. Also, I just logged in at ScottHorton.org/chat. ScottHorton.org/chat. That's the chat room. Yeah, it used to be you needed an X-Chat or a Chatzilla or a Pigeon or something like that. Now you can just go to ScottHorton.org/chat and it's right there embedded into the page. And you can hang out with the boys and girls in there and talk about stuff. You know, whatever you want. ScottHorton.org/chat. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. And you know what I did? I finally went ahead and turned my... I wasn't sure how this worked, but then I found out how it worked. I've turned my plain old Facebook page into the other kind. From the personal kind into the public kind, the businessy kind. You know what I mean. So I wasn't sure how this was going to work, but it turns out that, yeah, it turned all of my friends and followers into likes. In other words, everybody who was a friend on Facebook is still a friend, basically. They're just not called that anymore. But they're still, you know, subscribed to my feed, in other words. I can't figure out how to find the news feed anymore, though. It used to be I would just go to Facebook.com, that was it, and it would show me the news feed. But now if I do that, it shows me all the different pages I'm in charge of. Huh. Well, that's nice and everything, but what about if I want to see the news? I don't know. But anyway, I'm posting there now. Facebook.com/ScottHortonShow. So I get to keep my old URL. That's good. Doesn't seem to want to let me tag Eric Margolies in the show notes for today. That could be a problem. Aren't I still Facebook friends with Eric Margolies, huh? So, let's see, what if I put the at symbol in front of him? Will it recognize his name then? Nope, I guess there's a new different way to tag people that I don't know about yet. Alright, well, whatever. So, today's show. I'm tweeting it out too. By the way, the website, it's not just the documentary section, but the website's getting better and better. One of the things is I figured out how to finally make anything I post on the page. God dang it. Should now push automatically to Facebook and or Twitter, although the Twitter part seems to be working better than the Facebook part, but anyway. Soon we'll have a bookstore. Soon we'll have a sticker store. Soon we'll have different prizes and free gifts. and things like that that you would get for donating to the show. Right now, if you donate $100 or more, I'll send you a commodity disc. That's a 1 ounce silver piece from commoditydiscs.com. But soon I want to have it where you can get DVDs full of different archives or different books or whatever. Anyway, we're working on all that. ScottHorton.org. It's new and improved and a work in progress, too. ScottHorton.org. All right. So now, I did mention kind of in an offhand way there that Eric Margolies is going to be on the show today. Well, good thing, too, because Eric Margolies, he writes stuff a lot, and it's good. And he's been writing about the DPRK. You know, commie North Korea. And I thought, hey, you know what? Most people don't know a thing about the DPRK. Well, Eric Margolies knows all about it. So I'm going to talk with him on the show. And we got some more subjects to cover with Eric as well. In fact, maybe I could ask him about South Sudan. Eric Margolies, he's one of the few guys who really knows about all these places. I ask him about Yemen. He's like, oh, let me tell you all about Yemen. You know, because he's been there. All right. So, man, it's kind of hard for me to choose which stories to cover on the show first today. I think first it'll be spying on Israel. Israel joins protest of U.S.-British spying. From McClatchy Newspapers. Jerusalem. Israel is the latest country to express displeasure with reports of U.S. and British spying on its leaders. Although there was not a great deal of surprise over the revelations or suggestions that they would damage relations. Intelligence Minister Yuval Steinitz said Sunday that while Israel recognizes it as a likely target of intelligence gathering, foreign agencies monitoring the Prime Minister and Minister of Defense is not acceptable to us and not legitimate. Israel and the U.S. have an intelligence alliance and share the most sensitive material with each other, Steinitz added. He said the two countries must reach an agreement on mutual prevention of espionage. Reports of spying on Israel came from the cache of documents taken by former U.S. National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. Previous reports have described U.S. spying on the leaders of Germany, Brazil, and Mexico, causing considerable consternation in those countries. According to Germany's Der Spiegel, U.S. intelligence cooperated closely with British services in 2009 to intercept emails belonging to the Office of Israel's Prime Minister and Minister of Defense, then Ehud Olmert and Ehud Barak, respectively. In addition, Israeli media reported Sunday that Israel's defense establishment suspected the U.S. was using surveillance equipment to monitor Barak from an embassy apartment rented across the street from his, shortly before his appointment in 2007. Israel's current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is said to conduct himself with extreme caution on the assumption that he is an espionage target. Israeli media says he has no computer in his office, avoids using email and cell phones, and sometimes resorts to gestures in sensitive discussions. Yitzhak Ben Yisraeli, or Yisrael, a retired general and Tel Aviv University national security expert, says the report shouldn't come as a major surprise, as most countries go to great effort to obtain information. Yeah. Anyway, so they were spying on Ehud Barak. Big deal. Let's talk about Israelis spying on America. Well, they do get here to Jonathan Pollard, which is, you know, kind of one, two, skip a few, and never mind the rest of them. There's Ben-Ami Kadish, and, of course, Steve Rosen, and many other Israeli, famous Israeli spies. But now, oh, man. Oh, I know where it is. Well, I'm looking for a link. Be patient, god dang it. Well, I don't know what I'd do with it. Israel, Israel, China, China. Aha! Nope, that's not the one. God dang it, Bobby. Well, I had a story here. Let me find it. I had a story about, let's see, Israel, China. I'm trying to remember which website I read at. Oh, yeah, that was it. Arutz Shiva. So, right as the Israelis are crying, boo-hoo, stop spying on us. This is from IsraelNationalNews.com. Report, U.S. furious at Israel equipment transfer to China. That's what I call spying. A top Israeli defense official was forced to step down last week, according to Ma'ariv Sunday, after the United States expressed fury at Israel's decision to sell military equipment to China. Meir Shalit, the department head for defense exports at the defense ministry, announced his resignation last week. While Shalit did not announce the reasons behind his resignation, the report claims that he voluntarily resigned after U.S. official investigations last month over the transfer revealed that the move took place with his approval. Huh? Which move? Does that read like a sentence has been deleted in there somewhere? Shalit apologized to the U.S. in a visit late last week. The conflict, according to the Daily, stems from different interpretations of the military weapons support contract between the U.S. and Israel. Israel explained to U.S. officials that sensitive components of the equipment had been removed before the transfer and were being held in Europe. However, the U.S. insisted that the fact that equipment eventually made its way to China at all presents a security risk. Oh, to the Middle East. Yeah, uh-huh. The U.S. is concerned that the advanced technology could triple from China to Iran, according to the report. Iran tried to buy equipment from China at least once to boost its nuclear weapons production. Whatever. Stop lying. What is this? And then they're trying to link to that, too. What is that? Another story of theirs. The specific technology in question includes a miniature refrigeration system manufactured by Recor, which is used for missiles and in electro-optic equipment. The U.S. and Israel have clashed over weapons and Air Force transfers before. Between 2000 and 2003, the U.S. forced Israel to cancel the sale of Falcon airborne radar systems to China at a steep price of over $300 million in compensation fees. We got to pay them hundreds of millions of dollars to not give away the technology we give to them. China and Israel have strengthened their political and economic ties considerably over the past year. Yeah, let's see if they pay you $3.5 billion a year, every year, no matter what. No matter how many American citizens get shot four times at point-blank range in the head. Amazing. So, yeah, you picked a bad week to complain about America spying on you, Israel. Yeah, treacherous traitors. Oh, and then their link is to the magnet story. Oh, yeah, David Albright says if Iran tries to buy a magnet, it must be for nuclear weapons production. Well, that's fine as long as you don't read Gareth Porter to set you straight and teach you otherwise. Because you know somebody like David Albright especially puts out some crappy magnet story. Gareth Porter's going to debunk it. That's kind of his thing. And that one was, actually, David Albright is such a joke, such a widely laughed at joke now that there are no shortage of people debunking his ridiculous magnet story. Funny that Israel National News would try to stick with it. Why don't you tell us again about how the Revolutionary Guards were going to kill the Saudi ambassador in a restaurant bombing in D.C. too, huh? You know, as long as you're lying. All right. Oh, I know another thing I wanted to ask Eric about. is this report, also from McClatchy newspapers today, about whether Musharraf is literally going to stand trial on treason charges in Pakistan. You know, they've been really bucking over the drone issue lately. Chuck Hagel even made a trip over there. Maybe it was just a call. I think he made a trip to Pakistan to tell them that they have to outlaw and enforce the outlawing of anti-drone protests. The American Secretary of War went over there to say, knock off the protests. Enough free speech by Pakistani civilians, Pakistani citizens, who want to say over whether their government can give permission to the U.S. government to kill them with Hellfire missiles. Man, you know, Pakistan, this is something we definitely got to talk about with Eric today. Eric likes to point out that Pakistan is really four states combined with a single military holding it together. And that's basically all they got. Very fractionalized kind of a thing. And did I say fractionalized? Factionalized, whichever, if, with or without the R. And their grand national jirga is now asking the government to allow the Pakistani Air Force to shoot down the drones. Of course, while the military and the ISI are actually the ones giving permission for the drones to be used. But there have been huge protests over there against this. And, you know, I would urge you to take a little bit of time out to take a look at some of the studies done about the drone strikes. There's Life Under Drones was one. Chris Woods, formerly with the Bureau for Investigative Journalism, did some reporting like this. I'm trying to remember now who did Life Under Drones. Anyway, and then there's the latest Unmanned about the drone war is the movie by Robert Greenwald, no relation to Glenn. And anyway, part of what they talk about is the absolute terror. Yeah, pun intended and everything. The terror of being a man, woman, or child living in the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan with the buzz of American Predator and Reaper drones constantly overhead. Just read a few of those quotes of little girls explaining what it's like for them to be afraid all day, every day, that they're going to be blown up. A real fear. You know, I'm from Austin, where no one has ever done an air campaign of bombing my town. Can you imagine what that would really be like for, I don't know, say the youngest female member of your family to have to live like that? It's worth looking into and, you know, thinking about, reflecting upon, if you like, I'd say. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, so welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. So yeah, I got that new Facebook page up and going. It seemed kind of silly all the time to be stuck at a 5,000 friend limit, but now I can have an unlimited number of likes, so go and like me. Facebook.com/Scott Horton Show. And also, you know, I'm almost to 5,000 Twitter followers, too. So why don't you go follow me on Twitter, Twitter.com/Scott Horton Show. Yeah, more like that. In fact, I'm on Tumblr at Tumblr.com/Scott Horton Show. And now, explain to me this. Google Plus won't let me have Google Plus/Scott Horton Show. They'll let me have Google Plus/Scott Horton, but not with show on the end. They say that's not available. But when I try to go to googleplus.com/Scott Horton Show, there's nobody else there. There's nothing there. So how come I can't have it then, since that's the name of my show and everything? Which, you know, sort of raises the separate question of who the hell is looking at Google Plus. Anybody? I hadn't been on Google Plus since they invented it. I had a thing that was posting. Everything I posted would automatically get posted there for a little while. So, but that's the only, yeah, anyway. I don't know if anybody used that. But if you do them on there, if you want to look at it, it's not very interesting. Anyway, however, though, Facebook and Twitter /Scott Horton Show. Good times. Oh, yeah. And Tumblr, I don't know. I don't really understand Tumblr. It's just blogs, right? It's like typepad.com or blogger.org or whatever. Eh? Something like that. I don't get it. I don't know. But I got one. I got a Tumblr. Go and tumble on it. Everything that means. Well, so war in South Sudan. It's just like good old Charles Goyette was pointing out on the show the other day. Yeah, it's always the black swan. You never know quite where it's going to be. You don't know quite what's going to break out, but you know it's coming. Just sit back and watch for it because you know what's coming. Well, here the U.S., of course, engaged in a plot to break off South Sudan from the North, which they had fought for independence for a long, long time, and they deserved it, basically. I mean, who the hell ever invented Sudan except a bunch of white people from Europe in the first place, right? And so you had the black, Christian, and animist minority in the South, completely dominated and exploited and oppressed by the Arabs from the North. So, why shouldn't the South secede from the Union? That's fine. Except that, of course, there's a lot more to it than that. Like, kicking the Chinese out. Making sure that any oil developed in the South is developed by America or no one at all. That kind of thing. But now that South Sudan is a separate state. It's been, what, a year and a half or something. There's been an attempted coup and a growing civil war in South Sudan, which, you know, is to be expected. They were at war for a long, long time with the North. And so, to paraphrase Colin Powell, it's not like there are a bunch of Thomas Jeffersons waiting to set up a limited constitutional republic or anything like that. And even if there were, the CIA would have killed them. So, from Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com, U.S. getting dragged into South Sudan civil war. Rebels blamed for shooting U.S. warplanes. U.S. warplanes were sent to South Sudan to evacuate American citizens caught up in a failed coup and growing civil war in the nation and came under fire, injuring four. The rebels were immediately blamed. President Obama reported the deployment of 46 troops, could be worse, to the nation for evacuation and said he reserves the right to take further action. Using military assets in the nation. Officially independent since mid-2011. See what I say, a year and a half, right? South Sudan has had plenty of violence since and major oil fields which have attracted foreign investment. Unfortunately, as the situation destabilizes yet again, there are calls for the U.S. to intervene to protect those investments. Yeah, because where we intervene, stability always follows. We know that. The growing conflict in South Sudan is a split along ethnic lines, with the country's Dinka president accusing a former vice president, an ethnic Nuer, of orchestrating the violence. A military commander, reportedly loyal to the vice president, has declared himself a military governor of one of the most oil-rich states. You know, you really shouldn't have states. Because then whoever's in charge of it, they get to claim eminent domain over all of the supposed private property in the place. So there is no private property. It's communism. You know, like Sarah Palin's Alaska. And so instead of the people who own the oil getting to make the money off of it, the state does. And, yeah, guess what? People are willing to kill over that control. Same thing goes on all over the world, you know. You look at Nigeria on the other side of Africa, where the national government, if Shell bribes the national government will give them access to whatever oil they want in the country. And anybody who happens to live there, whose village goes back 1,000 years or whatever on that spot, screw them. Oil doesn't belong to them. You know, when I was a little kid, I used to think it was eminent domain. It sounds kind of like it, right? Eminent domain, like, hey, lady, there's a highway going through here. And sorry that your property rights ain't quite enough to make this highway have to go around your sorry ass. So move it. Here's fair market value. Now beat it. Now, I never really thought that was very fair, but it made sense to me that that's how society would operate a little bit, right? Eminent domain. There's a highway coming through imminently. But no, that's not what it means. Eminent domains. It means America is a communist dictatorship. And every state in the world is a communist dictatorship. And the government claims ownership of all the land eminently. Prior to any private property claim that someone else might have on any of that land. Isn't that messed up? You'd have thought that the Marxists won the Cold War or something.
I would.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And wow, did you guys hear the news that some lady that no one has ever heard of before said a racist thing on Twitter. Now, for the next half hour to talk about this, we're going to have five different guests with their wide and varied and important opinions. No, not really. I actually heard that on National Public Radio this morning. I try to listen to, well, this afternoon, I try to listen to as much NPR as I can because they're my enemy, you know, and I want to know what they're up to. And I'm just sick and tired of hearing the same old damned Aerosmith song on the classic rock station. I just, Sweet Emotion, stop it, please. Of all the Aerosmith songs, why do you have to just keep playing Sweet Emotion over and over again? I know the money, but ugh. So anyway, I was listening to NPR, and they had a whole roundtable discussion over a white girl tweeted a racist thing on Twitter, and what does it all mean? Really? And then the other topic of the week is a racist old redneck on a reality show said a racist old rednecky thing about blacks and about homosexuals. Oh, really? Wow. I don't know. See, for me, if I ever had to stop and think, wow, I sure am being bossed around and told what to think about a lot. Maybe I should find my own choices of what to be interested in. I would kind of be bothered by that. How the hell did I become a grown person and have it decided for me that the guy from the duck show is all I want to talk about this week? That would bother me if it was me. Really? Oh, pick a side, pick a side. Really? No. Here, let's talk about picking sides in the war in Syria. Who the hell was I reading earlier that had the quote from the State Department lady? What was it I was reading? Where the State Department lady was going, you know, the Islamic Front is not exactly on the terrorist list yet, even though it's otherwise known as the Al-Nusra Front, which is on the terrorist list. But since they've sort of renamed themselves, or they've recruited so many new members lately that they've created a new umbrella group, yeah, we can deal with them. So it wasn't the Fisk piece. What the hell was it? It's right there in my brain. Oh, it might have been the Robert Perry piece. Robert Perry. I got a grudge against him because he just wrote the dumbest damn thing in the world about libertarianism one time. It made me so freaking mad, but I do like his criticism of a lot of things, I have to admit. I'm trying to scan through his article now and see if this is the one. It would have been off topic a little bit. Because this is all about the sarin attack and the New York Times. No, that wasn't it. Man. Anyway, I was just reading earlier today. Or was it yesterday? Late last night? It was either late last night or earlier today. Somebody had the quote from the State Department lady. All right. God dang it, Horton. I'm going to try to find it. It's going to not work, but let me see here. Was it Victoria Nuland or whatever? Was that her name? I don't know which one it was. State Department. Syria Islamic Front. We can talk to them. Was it maybe talk to them? Talk to them. Oh, I know what it was, man. It was, I know exactly what it was, man. It was this article that Eric sent me to look at from Seamus, what's his name? Seamus Cook. Good stuff here. That's what it was. See, I told you I wasn't lying. Now I just got to find it. Marie Harf. This is the State Department spokeswoman. Marie Harf, quote, "We wouldn't rule out the possibility of meeting with the Islamic Front. We can engage with the Islamic Front, of course, because they're not designated terrorists. We're always open to meeting with a wide range of opposition groups." Seriously, this is, at this point, you have the former head of George Bush's secret torture police, Michael Hayden, who tortured men to death. He's saying, well, you know, maybe Assad would be a better bet. Back when I was the head of the secret torture police, we worked with Bashar al-Assad on torturing al-Qaeda guys to death all the time. Why in the world would we be backing al-Qaeda against them now? Now, what's funny about that is that's only a rough paraphrase. I mean, that's Michael Hayden's thing. That's the insanity of America's Syria policy right now. And so what's happened is this. As I've told you all along, there's no moderates in the Syrian war. Oh no, I gotta sneeze. Woo boy. Ain't no moderates in the Syria war. Here's a moderate in the Syria war. Ready? He weighs 250 pounds and he's really rich with piles of gold and probably gold chains like Run DMC back in the days. And he used to live in Virginia for 20 years and now he lives at the top of the nicest hotel in Doha, Qatar. Okay? That's your moderate Free Syrian Army rebel. You know, the closest he'd get to combat would be the top of the nicest hotel in Ankara or Istanbul. Okay? Meanwhile, who's actually fighting the war against Bashar al-Assad? Well, volunteers from across the Middle East. Extremists. People who are willing to die trying. Not moderates. So it's always been the case that whatever was so-called the Free Syrian Army was a bunch of expats who weren't anywhere near the battlefield, or they were people who were, you know, trying to collect American weapons and money, but they still were exactly what the CIA would call extremists if they were fighting against America, like, say, in the Iraq War. They would be al-Qaeda in Iraq. They would have been at least, that would have been half true. They would have called themselves the Islamic State, allied themselves with Zarqawi and them. And so then everybody else was the al-Nusra Front, or actually al-Qaeda in Iraq, now calling themselves al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Levant. The new Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. They're trying to create. I'm not saying they'll necessarily succeed, but then again, I'm not sure who's going to stop them. At this point, they are trying to create the ridiculous, al-Qaeda-ite, bin Laden-ite, Islamo-fascist caliphate right there in the heart of the Arab regions there. In between Sunni Iraq and Sunni Syria. Which, of course, they could have never done without America's war in Iraq. Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad, they were the number one and number two obstacles to such a thing even being imaginable. We went back 12 years ago. And so now, what's happened? Oh, one more thing about that. Any so-called moderates who were doing any fighting at all, they really were types that you couldn't call them moderates by any real American definition. For example, and I'm sorry, I have used this one over and over again, but geez, it's a really good one. When John McCain went to Syria to meet with the moderate Syrian opposition, he met the Northern Storm Brigade. A bunch of kidnappers. Now, later, they disputed whether the people in the photo were the same individuals who had kidnapped a bunch of Shiite pilgrims from Lebanon a few months before. And I don't know the exact answer to that. In fact, I believe where I left off, David Weigel was trying to be a dispassionate critic and was saying that there was some doubt as to whether the guys in the picture were the actual kidnappers or not. But so what? Anyway, same militia, the Northern Storm Brigade. And as far as vetting, it was that fraud from Kimberly Kagan's think tank, the Institute for the Study of War. That's Fred Fatneck Fred Kagan's wife, Kimberly Kagan. These neocons and their echo chambers, they're just magnificent the way they do this stuff. But anyway, she was the one who hired that girl, Elizabeth O'Baggy, who was the fake doctorate. And she was the one who, McCain couldn't even vet her and put her in charge of vetting the rebels he was meeting with. And she had him hook up with this Northern Storm Brigade, who, if you just Googled them, the first result was a Time Magazine interview. Time Magazine video from their website of them interviewing the Northern Storm Brigade, where at least one of them says, yeah, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War, where he fought against the Americans. And these were the guys that John McCain was palling around taking pictures with. And according to Elizabeth O'Baggy, and this seemed believable to me, John McCain wanted to spend the night there with the Syrian terrorists, with the Northern Storm Brigade veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He wanted to, as Daniel McAdams put it, have a pajama party. And only his security detail insisted that, no, we've got to call it quits here. And, you know, it's the Daily Caller, but it's friendly quotes of McCain's people talking directly to them. It's not like an expose based on anonymous sources or whatever. It's O'Baggy confirmed that McCain had to be restrained from spending the night. So it's not, you know, iffy. Amazing. So now, anybody who, never mind the sock puppets that the Americans try to put there having to endorse the rebellion, anybody who wants to take part in the insurgency at all, or not be on the receiving end of the Syrian insurgency's violence, they all have to join the rebellion now, the one led by the al-Nusra Front and ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they're foreigners from all over the region, just like during the Iraq War, foreigners from all over the region going there, and including Chechens, including Afghans. Americans are fighting Afghan Mujahideen, who are then saying, screw this, and hightailing it over to Syria, where they can be armed with American money and weapons and work for the U.S. Can you believe that? It's true, man. What's going on? But anyway, you know, not to distract you from news about your reality TV shows. I wouldn't want to get on your bad side. But Barack Obama is guilty of the highest treason. And really, McCain just as much as him, too. Wouldn't that be funny to see them both in the dock? You know, if there was such a thing, like in the fiction, like in the fantasy of having a rule of law that would apply to those who write the laws and enforce the laws. There was just some rogue Senate that would kick John McCain out of it, that would remove the president from office and then work with the Department of Justice on their prosecution. Just to say it, no matter how guilty they are, right? No matter how guilty they are, if they're outright handing the guns to people walking out of Ayman al-Zawahiri's house, they still could never in a zillion years be prosecuted. Ever. And we all know that. I just like pointing it out that you already know that if Barack Obama was literally handing the suicide belts two men leaving Zawahiri's house, where they've just been knighted into the Imperial Knights of Zawahiri's Qaeda, that they could never be prosecuted for treason. If all the paperwork came due, and there were 15 named sources indicating that, in fact, the leadership of both American parties have been infiltrated and compromised by the Russian FSB for the last 10 years. Still, what would happen? Every so-called law enforcement officer on the federal level would roll right over. Just like the American people. There is no treason that the American government can commit against the people of this country. And I mean literal treason, not like using it loosely treason, but literal treason. There is no literal treason they could commit against us that they could ever be held accountable for. That's how far down the slippery slope you already live. The president and his men, at the insistence as well of the leaders of the opposition party in the Congress, has been backing Al-Qaeda in Syria against their former ally, against Al-Qaeda. So it's not like they're ignorant of how useful the Ba'athists in Syria can be in keeping Al-Qaeda down. Bashar al-Assad used to work for George W. Bush for 8 years straight, and Bill Clinton before him. His job was torturing people. As Robert Baer, the former CIA officer, put it, if you want somebody to disappear, you send them to Syria. No, wait. If you want to torture somebody, send them to Syria. You want them to disappear forever, you send them to Egypt. Buried under the pyramids or something. I don't know. Nobody can ever find them again. Turn their corpses over to the pigs, like that movie about the crime ring in England there. Oh, no, that was a real news story, right? About the Italian mob boss that they fed to the pigs? Because the pigs will eat the bone. That's the thing. And to be perfectly clear, I don't think that Obama is Osama. I don't think he's a Muslim at all. Even if he spent time in a Muslim school as a kid or whatever, that doesn't mean anything to me at all. I do not think he's a secret agent of any terrorists or any foreign states. Except maybe Israel. But mostly, what he is he's an agent of the American Empire. And as an agent of the American Empire, he's made the judgment call that, yeah, let's go ahead and back Al-Qaeda in Syria a little bit. As long as we call it that we're not. And it'll help weaken Assad, and that'll help weaken Iran. Whatever, that's the judgment call they've made here. But it's still the highest of treason. I mean, the entire national security group running the Obama government over the last couple of years, whoever's been involved, they should all be in the dock for this. Simple as that. It's still treason. You don't have to be a damned birther to say that, like, hey, you know what? Here's the mathematical facts. Hezbollah's not attacked the United States. I don't care what you saw on your TV show. Hezbollah's not an agent of the terrorists against us. Hezbollah's never attacked America. Even the Beirut attack of the barracks in 1983, that was the Amal militia, not Hezbollah. Hezbollah's not a threat to the U.S. Hezbollah's only a threat to Israel in the sense that they have the ability to repel attack, okay? But that's not really what the term threat means, except to liars, so we'll waste no more time on that. But here, America is backing Al-Qaeda in an attempt to weaken Hezbollah. An attempt to weaken that Shiite crescent of power. You know, like Iran's buffer zone to its west, like Russia used to have with the Eastern Bloc. That's kind of how they see it, right? Iranian power as projected through Syria and into southern Lebanon. Yeah, but you know what? Iran never had that much power in the friggin' first place, and neither did the regime in Damascus either. And Hezbollah is nothing but a statelet within a state, and not even really that. I mean, they're a militia with some state-like responsibilities in a way, I guess, but they're not really a state. You couldn't consider them like a state in the Union, like we have in America, or a province in Canada or something like that, you know? They're nothing in terms of actual power. for Iran to project. So all this is the highest treason. To what end? The highest treason. The Democrats back in Al-Qaeda in Syria to what? Give Assad some... Give Nasrallah and Hezbollah some more training ground? They've been doing pretty good whenever they go and fight over there. So if it's supposed to weaken Hezbollah, I don't even see that that's even the case going on. And they've already apparently long since given up on the possibility of a real regime change in Damascus and agreed. Even the Israelis now are saying what a nightmare it would be if the Sunni-based insurgency actually took Damascus away from the Alawites and the Shiites and the Christian coalition that runs it. And really, for that matter, the non-Islamist Sunnis. It would be a nightmare to have a bunch of Al-Qaedaites controlling the capital city, really changing the regime. They don't want that. But they just want to, you know, back them some. They just want to create another gigantic gladiator academy training ground, as though the one that we've created, that the U.S. has created in the Sunni Triangle in Iraq, wasn't big enough. And talk about blowback. I mean, give me a break. You look at how we got into this mess, and then just look forward. Just guess. You don't even have to be a pessimist about it. You could be half full, half anything about it. As Carlin said, that glass is way too big about it. And just look. There's going to be Al-Qaedaite, Bin Ladenite. I'm trying to define the term very generally speaking. Those who've sworn loyalty to Zawahiri's goals, etc. There are going to be attacks by those guys on Western targets for generations to come. Already because of what George Bush did in the war that he fought in Iraq. But what Obama has done in helping to spread this thing, in helping the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks to spread this thing. I didn't mean that second part as a replacement for the first, like a clarification. I mean all those things together. Obama's been backing them outright. Even the David Sanger New York Times version of this thing is the CIA's been funneling a lot of money and guns into this thing, and it's all ending up in the hands of the suicide bombers, the prisoner beheaders, the Bin Ladenites, the Nusra Front, and the Islamic State, blah, blah, blah. That's even the official version, happens to be true in this case. And anyway, it's funny because, you know, Michael Oren, the former ambassador, Israeli ambassador to the United States, was quoted in the Jerusalem Post saying that, yeah, well, of course, we support those bad guys against these bad guys. And he clarified that he meant, yeah, Al-Qaeda. He wants the Sunni insurgency, the Sunni Islamist insurgency in Syria to win over the Ba'athists and over Hezbollah. Why? Because Hezbollah is backed by Iran. You know, these are the people who describe their every thought process as intelligence and calculus. Well, our calculus has changed. Wow, I never even got to calculus class. I better let these brilliant mathematicians figure out what to do. Really? You really prefer Al-Qaeda to Iran or to anyone that's friends with Iran? Have you thought this through at all? Did you actually, what was your answer when you did the calculus? What came up at the end? That Al-Qaeda would be, what, weaker? Yeah, but how about easier to control than the Ba'athist dictatorship? Come on. They're crazy. And then it was just a couple of weeks ago, it was also in the Jerusalem Post, that the former head of Mossad said, we have decided that that's a bad policy and we want Assad to stay. Oh my God, these people. You know what? And sitting here doing what amounts to pirate radio all this time here, internet radio, and before that, just pirate radio. A little bit of KPFK here and there on this show. This is Amateur Hour Foreign Policy. This is just some guy who hates American foreign policy a lot and can't get over it and so shows up every day show. That's all it is. And man, this is what we've been saying for years, including talking with Eric Margulies, who's coming up next. You could go back to my shows in 2007, 8, 9, 10, etc. and find any time that Syria is mentioned at all. The question being, these neocons, these Israelis, are so convinced that they want to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. But what are they, smoking crack? Who the hell they think's going to replace them? And I'm talking going back to before any of the Arab Spring broke out in 2011 or any of that. And the question is, from Israel's point of view, put yourself in their shoes. How stupid would they have to be to prefer anyone to the stable, quiet, peaceful Baathist dictatorship in Syria? They would have to be complete nut jobs. And then here's the thing of it. They really are complete nut jobs. From David Wurmser and Paul Wolfowitz and Bill Kristol and the whole Kagan family to Benjamin Netanyahu and Ehud Barak, these guys and Michael Oren, they are nutballs. The people who rule Israel and therefore the Israel lobby, the entire Israel lobby and neoconservative movement in America, they are just dead wrong about everything that they think is a good idea. From their permanent apartheid occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and for that matter, how they treat Arab citizens of their own country, Christian and Muslim alike, to their clean break policy. As Michael Ledeen put it in National Review all those times over the years, faster please, let's turn the Middle East, all of it, Arab and Persian alike, from the West Bank to India, let's turn it all into a boiling cauldron of death and pain and explosions and instability. And then, you know, whatever, it'll work itself out and be great. Not just anybody listening to this show, anybody thinking about it at all knows better than this. Anybody but the people with the power to decide.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Scott Horton Show. Check out the new and improved website at scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003, plus whole show archives and my stress blog. And got a brand new section at scotthorton.org/documentaries, none of which I made, but all of which I thought were good and worth passing on to you, as many as I could think of anyway. Send me suggestions, scott@scotthorton.org, any documentaries that you want to see there in the new documentary section. And also, if you want, join up the chat room during the show. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Oh, and one more thing. Check out my new and improved Facebook page at facebook.com/scotthortonshow. It's now the kind you like instead of the kind you friend, which is different. All right. Eric Margulies is on the line. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How's it going?
Oh, it's good. We've got so much news, I don't even have time to do my Christmas shopping.
I know. It's really hard to get it done. My lucky break is I don't have much money for spending on presents for anybody, so my shopping is limited anyway. I can sit home and read and go crazy.
Very wise.
Yes. That was my plan all along, actually. Give myself more opportunity to go crazy. No, I appreciate having you on the show, as always, foreign correspondent. Eric Margulies. Been all around the world quite a few times and covered more wars than all the other reporters combined. And he wrote some books, too. War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And he's now writing at unz.com, UNZ.com, as well as LouRockwell.com and his own website, EricMargulies.com, spelled like Margolis, EricMargulies.com. And here at the UNZ Review, remember we were talking with Phil Giraldi about UNZ.com, the UNZ Review, UNZ.com. And here, Eric's latest piece is Kim Shows His Fangs. And I was very happy to see this because it's very rare. There are very few writers who really know their stuff about North Korea, and even fewer who are buddies of mine, who I can get on the show at a moment's notice to teach me all these things I need to know about North Korea, and to teach everybody else, too, because, you know, I was having a conversation with somebody who said, "Man, what's our problem in North Korea? Don't they make all our cars and electronics and stuff?" And I thought, you know, people, they need their straightening out who makes what and who the North Koreans are. Let's start at year zero here. Who and what is North Korea? Who's running it now? And what's he showing his fangs about?
I've been watching North Korea since 1975. I find it a fascinating place, as I do South Korea, too, home of one of the great economic miracles of our time. North Korea, Korean culture is more than 1,000 years old. Korea was always considered, the United Korean Peninsula, as sort of a younger brother of China. It always had close relations with China, kind of followed the Chinese line on things. But at the end of World War II, Communist Party in North Korea, which was backed by Stalin, took power. It then began skirmishing with the South Korean, who were backed by the United States. They had a very nasty despot named Kim Il-sung, who was running North Korea, very close to Stalin. And we had our own despot named Syngman Rhee, a fanatical South Korean Christian. Both sides were miserable. Both sides taunted the other. And eventually they went to war with North Korea invading South Korea, almost pushing it off the map. U.S. intervened, hence the 1950 Korean War. And after all the fighting we did, after years of fighting and tens of thousands of Americans dead, ended up at exactly the place they started on the 38th parallel. So that's the story. And the two Koreas have been at daggers drawn ever since, with an enormously prosperous South Korea and with a decrepit and failing North Korea.
And even an official state of war between the two that's held this whole time, right? Nothing but a ceasefire rather than any kind of real peace agreement at the end of that war.
That's right. That's right.
And then, of course, that makes a great talking point for the North Koreans that, oh, yeah, well, we're going to suspend the ceasefire here any minute now if you don't look out, which they seem to bellow once or twice a year anyway, right?
I love North Korean political pronouncements on TV. They're a scream to watch. It makes me nostalgic for the Cold War. They have wonderful vocabularies, come up with the most hair-raising accusations. But the North Koreans have something to back it up, and that is they have a 1.1 million-man army, which, though equipped with obsolescent equipment, very tough and very competent, and most important, the North Koreans have 11,000 pieces of heavy artillery and rocket batteries targeted in on Seoul, the South Korean capital, where almost half of all South Koreans live. It's only about 30-40 kilometers away from the north, and whose guns are dug into caves in the DMZ. So the north has a credible threat to make, and it routinely says it's going to burn Seoul to the ground if the Americans do anything. Plus, the North Koreans now have an estimated 3 to 6 crude nuclear weapons, and God knows what they would do with them. There are also 28,000 American troops sitting in South Korea. So the North can do a lot of damage.
Yeah, and sounds like all pretty quickly, too, with all that artillery there. But then again, I mean, the ceasefire is held all this time, and no side really has an interest in escalating beyond a bunch of chest beating, right?
That's correct. The North Korean regime is really interested in keeping itself in power. I've spent a lot of time in South Korea, and the people who are most worried about the bellicosity of the North Koreans are the Americans. South Koreans sort of shrug it off, even all these nuclear alarms, and there they go again. It's like having a demented uncle tucked away in the attic or something like that. I can tell you that what really scares the North Koreans is not an attack by North Korea, but what they call unexpected reunification. And that means that the North collapses, mm-hmm. and suddenly 25 million starving North Koreans start pouring south across the border, and that means that South Korea will have to take over the feeding and the rebuilding of North Korea, something that they really don't want to do.
Yeah, well, you know, I've heard it said, too, that, and maybe by you, that, you know, the Americans really don't want that reunification, either planned or unplanned, because then you combine the South's economy with the North's nukes. Although I'm not sure if they've figured out how to implode a plutonium bomb yet. That's kind of difficult to make it go off right, I guess. But you combine those and you really have a new separate power on par with Russia and China, if not exactly economic-wise, with an extra little boost for their possession of nuclear weapons there, and then that's just a whole new obstacle to deal with if you're trying to maintain the Pacific Ocean as an American lake, right?
That's right. It adds complexity. The Chinese are very worried that if North Korea collapses, that the U.S. will move military bases into North Korea, which are right next door to Manchuria, which is one of their key industrial and military areas.
Which they probably would, right?
Yes, they probably would, for security reasons, of course.
Yeah.
And it's kind of irresistible. The Japanese don't want to see United Korea because the Koreans hate the Japanese. And that's the last thing that they want to see. Japan has been quietly supporting North Korea. One of the main sources of hard cash for the North Korean government were pachinko parlors in Japan. There's like these upright pinball machines that Japanese love like crazy, and all these places were run by ethnic North Koreans in Japan. They kept financing the North Korean government. So it's a complicated situation. The Russians don't want to see any more American presence there either. The Chinese are nervous about the whole situation, because they could live certainly with the United Korea, but not if it falls under America's thumb.
Right. All right. So now talk all about the grandson here, Un, and his executed uncle.
Well, Un, who's somewhere between 27 and 30 years old, went to school in Switzerland. Young guy. He came to power at the death of his father, Kim Jong-il, who was the son of Kim Il-sung. So this is a dynasty. This is a Stalinist Korean hereditary dynasty. And young Kim was, there were a lot of questions whether he would be able to run things, whether he was going to grab all the reins of power, whether he was going to be told what to do by his powerful uncle and aunt, or by the powerful generals in the army. So and he was greeted with much derision and jocularity. And he surprised people, because first thing he did was to get to can a lot of the top generals of the huge North Korean army. And then he just had his uncle, uncle-in-law, hauled out of a court a council meeting by the police, taken out a shot. And in Confucian culture, this is just a big no-no. You don't have your uncle-in-law shot like that. And but he did, and shocked everybody. And to me, it's certainly a sign of some grave crisis going on. Because normally, even if his uncle had been a big problem, if had him thrown in jail, poisoned him quietly and said that he died of a heart attack, but to take him out and shoot him, shows weakness in the regime, shows something really bad going on, and shows very un-Confucian filial impiety.
Well, I mean, there, as best I understand, there's the biggest faction split inside the state is between the Communist Party and the military. Is, do you know which side the uncle was aligned with, and does this signal a shift toward the other, that kind of thing?
Well, you know, this is like old Kremlin watching used to be.
Or D.C. watching.
Or D. I wonder, you know, what color hat they're wearing. And his uncle was supposedly close to the generals of the North Korean army, the DPRK's army. I haven't heard much from the Communist Party, but no doubt that the army and the Communist Party share all the spoils. Food, perks, travel, cash, things like that. And there's always a certain built-in conflict between the two of them of who gets more. The rest of the North Koreans are left in the lurch to be very hungry. What was interesting that came out of this was that one of the statements, the uncle was accused of womanizing and drug dealing and being a gutter snipe and all kinds of things, but it said that, and he was doing this while the North Korean economy was in a catastrophic phase. So the government in North Korea finally admitted what everybody else knows, that they are in a catastrophic state.
Yeah, well, and about that, too, I know it's a real communist country. I mean, maybe the only real communist one around, maybe ever. So that just means everybody goes hungry all the time, and occasionally we hear stories, although usually in more tabloid papers like the Daily Mail or something, but occasionally from other places talking about, and I guess this happened under Mao in China too, and I guess in Ukraine under Stalin, people resorting to cannibalism in order to try to survive. Do you give much credence to reports like that? Is it really that bad in North Korea right now?
I treat them with great caution because the South Korean intelligence service is always busy cooking up wild stories about North Korea, and some of them are true, most of them are not. South Korea's Christians, who are very militant and very, very anti-communist, are also spreading stories like that. So you have to take them with a grain of rice, but certainly ugly things are going on there in the north.
Yeah, I guess, you know, that's regardless of whether they're really eating each other's kids or whatever, it's still, you know, the epitome of desperation there. And they are that hungry, right? Eating bark off the trees and whatever.
Well, you don't have a lot of tourists going to North Korea. Yeah, that's got to tell you something.
Hey, by the way. I'm of the opinion, and maybe we've talked about this before, but if we did, it was a while back. What do you make of Dennis Rodman and the Harlem Globetrotters and all that kind of thing? I think I heard he went back there, or he's going back there. He's going to train their entire basketball team, this kind of thing.
I think it's good. You know, I remember the opening to China began with ping pong diplomacy when nobody would talk to anyone else. And the more contacts we have with North Korea, it's good. This is good unofficial diplomacy. I'd pat him on the back if I could reach that high. And I saw a wonderful photo of Kim Jong-un with Dennis Rodman sitting a little ways to his left and Un turning to one of his aides saying, "You mean that's not President Obama?" So, you know, good. Let him see what I can do. He may have a civilizing mission there.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it was George Stephanopoulos said to Dennis Rodman that, well, you know, they've got 200,000 people in prison camps. And Dennis Rodman says, yeah, Obama's got 2 million people in prison camps. So what?
That's true. That's a very good answer.
And so really, yeah, I mean, this guy is a blood-soaked monster, but so that makes him the same as any other politician that a celebrity like Dennis Rodman would be expected to stand next to and smile. So I can only see the good in it, you know?
I'm with you.
Different than him hanging out with a Republican.
No, I'm with you. We need a different policy towards North Korea. A lot of what North Korea is doing is, you see, we've waged economic war against North Korea since the Korean War. That's over 60 years ago, and we're still trying to overthrow the government there.
Yeah. All right. You know what? We're going to pick that up on the other side of this short break, and then we're going to move on. We got a lot more topics to cover. We're lucky enough we got Eric Margulies on the line. From ericmargulies.com, lourockwell.com, and unz.com. That's UNZ, unz.com. We'll be right back after this. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. We're on Liberty Express Radio, live Monday through Friday from 3 to 5. Although, it's Christmas this week, so this would be my one and only show this week. I don't know, maybe I'll be back Friday. Yeah, probably not. Maybe, though. Anyway, I wanted to remind you real quick, y'all, that on February the 15th, there's the International Students for Liberty Conference in D.C., and the Future Freedom Foundation is putting on a whole giant thing there, and John Glazer and I will be giving a talk on libertarianism versus the empire. So, if you can get to D.C., February 15th, show up. It should be great. And there's going to be Stephen Kinzer and a whole lot of other people are going to be giving a lot of great talks, too. Robert Higgs and, okay. So you can find out all about that at fff.org. All right, now back to our friend Eric Margulies, ericmargulies.com, lourockwell.com, unz.com. We're talking about his piece, Kim Shows His Fangs, here at unz.com, about the DPRK. And now, so when the break interrupted us, Eric, you're talking about regime change and how the policy still is, you know, I guess, never negotiate away outstanding issues between our two countries, from our government's point of view, that is. Never negotiate these issues away, keep them, so that someday there'll be an excuse for a regime change, hook or crook, right? Hell or high water, whether that means war or some kind of fancy CIA coup if they think they can get away with that, or just hang on until the whole place goes completely bankrupt, or what exactly does that mean anyway?
Well, we've used the same policy towards Iran and North Korea, and that is the American argument is, well, these are despicable, horrible people. We wouldn't even shake their hands, and we refuse to confer legitimacy on them by negotiating. The other side of the argument is, you know, it's stupid if you don't negotiate with people. That's what diplomacy is about. If you're ever going to achieve anything, you have to start entering into dialogue with them. Mind you, we have no problem kissing the hands of the Egyptian government, which has turned out to be one of the most brutal fascist governments in memory, or Uzbekistan, or China, for that matter. But we won't deal with the North Koreans. And that's tied up with the Asian political situation we were just talking about, but also the fact that North Korea has gotten involved in the Middle East. And the neocons in Washington have been working for a decade to sabotage any agreement or any opening to North Korea, because North Korea is regarded as a potential weapon supplier to the Arab states and Iran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the whole proliferation security initiative that John Bolton came up with that helped push him out of the NPT, was the declaration
right.
that we're going to seize all their boats on the high seas and all that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, back in 02. Well, and so, I mean, it seems to me like any regime change there would mean reunification kind of by necessity, right? It'd be like the fall of the wall and reunification in Germany. There'd be no way around it if the communist regime fell, right?
It would be, but I'm telling you, South Korea's economy is not that strong to be able to rebuild North Korea and feed 25 million people. The Koreans would do it. I mean, the Koreans can do practically anything. You know, close to 1960, the gross income per capita in South Korea was about the same as Central Africa at that time. Mm-hmm. And North Korea was actually, at the end of the Korean War, actually had a bigger economy than South Korea. But these amazing Koreans, by sheer work, willpower, built themselves up to the world's 11th economy and are continuing to do it. So, yeah, they can do it, but look how long it took Germany to absorb East Germany. Koreans are afraid that this would bankrupt their economy.
Right. All right. Now, so I want to ask you about that fascist dictatorship in Egypt that you mentioned there. I want to hear a lot of what you have to say about that. But for the last couple minutes before the bottom of the hour break, I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about Mandela. My thing is I took that week off when he died and everybody was talking on and on about Mandela. And so I didn't do, you know, focus on him on the radio and all that. It all blown over. Everybody was just talking about the sign language guy by the time I was back. But what a scandal that was. You know, I don't know. I figure I have no idea really what you have to say about him. But I figure you obviously must have a lot to say about him and probably something wise. So why don't you tell us your kind of thumbnail, what we should take away from his death and mourning here.
I was covering southern Africa, Angola, Mozambique, Namibia, et cetera, during that period in the late 80s. So I was there just as he was getting out of prison. I almost got an interview with him. I have enormous respect for Mandela because he probably prevented a race war in South Africa by tempering the anger and bloodlust of his people. Yes, he was a communist. He headed up the militant wing of the African National Congress that was attacking whites and planting bombs in cafes and murdering little white farmers isolated. I was with the South African anti-guerrilla squads. I saw it myself. They were committing acts that were terrorism. And in fact, I believe Mandela was on the U.S. terrorist list until sometime in the 1978 or something like that. He denounced Israel as a imperialist, as a racist state, practicing colonialism. For this, he has never been forgiven by supporters of Israel or parts of the American media. But all in all, Mandela he set a great role model. Nobody will follow it, but South Africa, he was called the Black Jesus. And in some ways, he really was.
Yeah, it seems like all the fighting about is whether he was really a communist or not, or whether he was just palling around with him. And everybody wants to take sides right and left over whether he was good or bad. But it seemed like you know, I don't understand why it's so hard for people to say, well, you know, on one hand this and on the other hand that. But everybody wants to just be, you know, pro or anti. So.
Well, this is because we in America much too often impose our domestic political stances on foreign affairs situation. And it's a terrible mistake.
Yeah.
Mandela was not a black Jesus, in my view, but he was pretty much like a South African Gandhi.
Which, hey, that's not so bad, you know,
you.
As long as people are categorizing you. He was known as the Gandhi of this region. Okay, all right, we'll take that. All right, so hang on one more minute, Eric, and we'll be back. I won't keep you the whole rest of the hour, though, I promise.
Okay.
All right, it's Eric Margolies, ericmargolies.com. American Raj is the book. Go buy it and read it.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy. And all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. Hey, there's Dennis Rodman, returns from North Korea, live on CNN right now. What do you know? I knew that was going on, didn't I? All right, we got Eric Margolies on the line. He wrote War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination, foreign correspondent for many, many years, now writing for LouRockwell.com and UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. His piece is Kim Shows His Fangs. But now it's time to ask about Egypt. You just referred to the government there as a brutal fascist dictatorship. But whatever happened to John Kerry said that they're just restoring the democracy over there.
Well, his nose should grow much, much longer. You know, I'd hope that Kerry would be a more forceful and a more honest Secretary of State, but he hasn't gotten off to a brilliant start. He's done some good things, but not that. And the case of Egypt is really shameful. Here we helped promote the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Mohamed Morsi in Egypt. We cooperated in a campaign to destabilize and overthrow him. And we then refused to call it a military coup, even though tanks had killed, you know, crushed the demonstration. Over 11 to 1,400 demonstrators were gunned down in the street. If this happened in Iran, we'd be yelling bloody murder, but happened in Egypt, well, it's too bad. And what's happened is that out of the turmoil there has come a military junta. But it's the nature of this junta that's very unusual. It's not your run-of-the-mill Arab generals. This seems to be General al-Sisi, was supposedly an ally of President Morsi, who's now in jail, by the way, has turned out to be the closest I've seen in a long time since my days in the 1980s in Lebanon to this weird growth of Arab fascism. It's very ugly. There are mass arrests going on in Egypt. Mubarak's repressive engines have all been restarted again. The police are everywhere, mass arrest, torture, you name it, and all to glorify the Egyptian army.
It's, all right, now, hold on 1 second. Two things. First of all, your phone sounds a little screwy, so I wonder if maybe you're stretching the cord there at a weird angle, something like that.
Maybe. Sorry.
And then secondly, how would you differentiate the fascism in this military dictatorship from the way it was under Mubarak?
Mubarak, this is always an excellent question, Scott. What is the difference between fascism and just extreme right-wing conservative government?
Your phone still sounds really bad, too. Is there a plug you can tighten, you think? Maybe that's it? Or
don't. I'm on my landline. We've been having communications problems here because of a mass ice storm.
Oh, that could be it. But you sound a bit better now, so let's go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting there.
Okay, Professor Paxton at Columbia University has written an excellent book on the subject called Totalitarianism. And really the way you differentiate fascism from extreme right-wing governments, like Franco in Spain was not a fascist, he was extreme right-winger. But the fascists have a certain key elements, which are the exaltation of the military, the need to keep looking for foreign enemies, the glorification of the Egyptian or the Euro people as being extraordinary. The leader is above all question. He incarnates the will of the people. And you are constantly assailed by foes from the outside and subversives from within.
It sounds a little bit like a certain superpower I know.
Oh, well, you may be right.
But now, so is in what way is Sisi's government really different than Mubarak's?
Mubarak's was extremely repressive. In fact, when I was in Egypt, I was amazed. I had people, security agents, following me around with notebooks and things, taking notes of everywhere I went, everything I saw. It was an extremely repressive government, one of the world's most repressive and brutal, but the Western media shut its eyes to that and never reported on that. So we've gone back to that in Egypt, but whereas the Mubarak regime tried to keep it undercover, the Sisi regime is just pulling people off the streets and throwing them in jail and throwing children in jail and threatening to mow down more people if they get in the way. So it's much more brutal.
Yeah, you know, I talk with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, who lives in Cairo from time to time, and he was talking about how it's sort of this really kind of bad choice that the liberals, if you can call them that, I guess, more the April 6th movement and the labor union socialists and that kind of thing, maybe the richer citizens of Cairo or a certain part of town or something, that they really had made a bad choice in siding with the military against the Muslim Brotherhood. Because even though the Muslim Brotherhood was, you know, against what they wanted in terms of policy in a lot of ways, they still were abiding by the rules of win some, lose some in the electoral process. And it seemed like the liberals should have been making themselves allies of the process more than anything else. Now they've sided with the military, which has just canceled any citizen influence at all, and started arresting them too.
Well, it's most unfortunate. A lot of these so-called liberals or city dwellers, urban elite, are having a nasty surprise. They'll learn to live with the military as they did with Mubarak, I suggest. But what happened was that the reason that the coup occurred, what laid the groundwork for it, was that the secret police and the military and certain outside powers caused massive social disruption in Egypt. There were interruptions of food supplies, electricity failures, gas failures. The police were pulled off the streets. You know, that's a very scary thing. I was in Cairo, and suddenly there were no police, and people were being attacked, and women were being raped. It was never heard of in the past. So they completely destabilized the society there taking a leaf from the old Iran playbook during the days of Mossadegh. And it got everybody so angry at the government, which was helpless, couldn't do anything, that that opened the way for the coup.
And you know what? Heard it here first. I mean, Phil Giraldi a year ago, almost a year ago, I think it would have been January of this year, 2013, which 6 months before the coup, was saying, yeah, I'm hearing from CIA friends that the Saudis are bankrolling rent-a-mobs and turning protests into violent riots.
Sure they did. And Egypt's finances were attacked abroad from Wall Street, and the Bahrainis and the, you know, the Gulf states were also supporting these rent-a-mobs and the people moving against Egypt. And in fact, we can see, because they've now forked out up to $18 billion to Egypt to finance the current regime.
All right. Now, is it okay if I keep you longer and ask you more things?
You're holding me prisoner. I can't escape. This is okay. Radio Guantanamo.
Yeah, exactly. We'll shackle you to the wall and make you answer the question.
Okay.
Tell me all about South Sudan. Nobody else can, Eric, not like you.
Oh, interesting story. Interesting. Sudan used to be Africa's largest country. It was created by the British. And being British, they did what they did all over the world, is they welded together all sorts of disparate peoples, tribes, languages, and religions just for their colonial convenience. So in Sudan, you had in the northern part of Sudan was a so-called Arab culture, speaking Arabic, predominantly Muslim. And then in the south of Sudan, the far south, which is really Central African, it's very jungled and remote, you have two very strong ethnic tribes, the Nuers and the Luers, and the Dinka, who are predominantly animist and then Christian, no Muslims, and they were ruling in the south. And they've been fighting the north for, 20 years. And they've been fighting each other for 20 years because these tribes on the Upper Nile fought each other for cattle and women. Stone Age kind of behavior. But the U.S. learned that there was oil in South Sudan. And since the Sudanese government has refused to play ball with Washington, they were on our doo-doo list anyway. So over the past few years, we, the United States, engineered the official breakup of Sudan, and South Sudan, which has all of Sudan's oil that was discovered just by coincidence, broke away from Sudan. Under American tutelage, with American advisors, with American money and help, and set up this independent South Sudan. So that's where we are today.
Well, and then now there's been a coup and a civil war inside South Sudan, and Obama's threatening, in his language, he left open further intervention, not just sending in the Marines to help citizens escape, which citizens meaning spies, I guess, whoever, State Department goons. But leaving, I forget his exact words, but it sounded like he was leaving the door open to further intervention being possible.
Oh, it's already underway.
Further action, he called it.
Powers, Obama has this Susan Powers and Susan Rice, these two women who are both ardent Africa firsters. And they've got this onward Christian soldier thrill to be going helping the abused people in Africa. They're sort of like liberal neocons, and they've obviously influenced Obama. But what's happening is that the South Sudan government is being propped up by the Americans, and we found out just yesterday that the U.S. had flown helicopters first to Osprey. Planes, these are two engine sort of tilt rotor planes, into the oil fields area of Sudan to extract American CIA and special forces units. What they were doing there, no one has said, but it's very interesting. So they were exfiltrated out of the combat area UN people who are working for the United States, because the UN has become in many areas an arm of the U.S. State Department, were also pulled out. But now we learn that troops from another American protectorate, which is Uganda, are moving into the capital and heading for Juba, which is the capital in the south, and possibly Ethiopian troops may also be on the way. These are troops from this American Entente in southern Africa that have been very close to American policy and have gotten a lot of American dollars.
All right, with that, I'll let you go. Thanks for staying overtime, especially, Eric, and doing the show.
My
today.
Pleasure.
Merry Christmas to you.
Merry
Talk
Christmas to you. Cheers.
All right, everybody, that is the great Eric Margulies. I kept him way over time. Soon I'll have to have him back to ask him about Musharraf. And is he really going on trial over there for treason? Certainly he's guilty of treason. But anyway, so that'll be coming up soon. The great Eric Margulies, ericmargulies.com, and now he's also writing for uns.com. All right, that was my really crappy cue. I had the light on, but the thing wasn't turned up, or the other way around. Anyway, that was the break between that segment and this one. You like it? That's what I call radio production. I'm the only one who calls it that, but that's good enough. All right. So, yeah, good. So, the National Defense Authorization Act has passed. And it's funny to me. You know, I hadn't even had a chance to read this article, so I'm not even talking about the article. The JPEG attached to the article is Bill of Rights suspended. Please stand by due to the NDAA. And I just thought it was so interesting to me. I don't know whether it'll be interesting to you when I say it. I'm starting to suspect maybe not. But it's very interesting to me that NDAA, the letters NDAA, has come to mean in America, that's shorthand for Bill of Rights suspended. That means prison without trial. That means military detention without trial for anyone. Even if you're a natural-born citizen of the USA. Because, yeah, they put that in there. And under the broadest of definitions, too. Oh, an associated force. And then, what about an associated force? How close do you have to be to an associated force? And how close does that associated force have to be with anything that could be construed as the remnants or the byproduct of whatever Sunni insurgency we were fighting back when. They're pretty vague on all that, just like me. And there was a federal judge who was sued, the feds were sued by the likes of Chris Hedges and Daniel Ellsberg, and I forget who all, the ACLU. And a judge agreed with them and said, hey man, you know, a federal judge said, hey, this language is really broad and could, in fact, include, you know, these people. Of course, the fight always with these courts is over, and with the federal government in the federal courts, is always over standing and whether anyone has the right to sue. And they'll define that as narrow as they possibly can. So unless you can show me where Daniel Ellsberg has already been held in military detention without trial, then he doesn't have standing to say that he thinks that he might be at some point. And they'll try to define it out of existence. But what this judge found was that actually some of these plaintiffs, like Chris Hedges, for example, he used to report for the New York Times. You might remember his stories about how Saddam was best friends with Osama. Yeah, great job, Chris. Anyway, he talked with Al-Qaeda guys from time to time as a New York Times reporter. Well, so that meant he had their phone numbers. That meant that the government might be of the opinion at any time that whatever he tells, whatever he writes in the newspaper about what he's told by these men amounts to PR for them. Like, for example, did I ever tell you about that time that Chris Hedges printed a bunch of lies about Saddam being best friends with Osama? Well, whose interest was that in? Osama's. So you could make a compelling argument that acting as an unwitting, useful dupe of Osama bin Laden and Dick Cheney, Chris Hedges in the New York Times implicated Saddam Hussein in training and financing and having anything to do with Al-Qaeda. So therefore, he's a servant of a foreign power, so therefore he could be locked in Guantanamo forever. See? There, standing. Doesn't seem that hard. And this federal judge said, yeah, you know, I'm concerned that even though Chris Hedges is a citizen of this country, that he could be detained by the military for the rest of his life without trial under this legislation. And of course, she was overruled by an appeals court. And I don't know whether it's still continuing on from there. I guess it's up to the Supreme Court whether they decide they want to hear it or not. So it might just die there at the federal appeals court level. Some three-judge panel went ahead and said, you know, nuts to you, lady, and went on and reinstated it. And then that was two NDAAs ago. Now they're passing the National Defense Authorization Act of 2014. And this is the war bill. This is the Pentagon bill. This is the America versus the world bill. And it seems kind of fitting to me. I'm not saying it's fair, because I'm an individualist. It's not fair that it would apply to me. It's not fair that it would apply to you. But in a way, you gotta admit, it's kind of poetic that it's in the Pentagon Appropriations Bill, which the American people stand for, being passed every year to the tune of $700 billion to inflict violent force, the threat of the extinction of mankind over the people, over the heads of the people of the world, that this would be the bill that also threatens to finally, once and for all, upend the Fifth Amendment protections on Star Chamber trials for American citizens, too. Chalmers Johnson tried to warn you. He went to his grave trying to warn you. You know, his last book, How To, a 12-step program, how to dismantle your empire and save your society. Please. And then he died. And he was trying to tell you, if you don't give up your empire, you'll live under it. Like, for example, you'll be so broke that it's going to take a SWAT team to wring every last dollar out of your pocket, you and everybody else, in order to keep the imperial state itself going. You know, as far as they're concerned, occupying the planet, the world empire will be the last thing in the budget to go. And already, just look at what the Republicans and the Democrats did. Patty Murray, didn't someone say she was an anti-war Democrat or something? She's totally on board for this thing. She just worked this giant deal with Paul Ryan, who of course completely sold out the right and passed what could have been a Ted Kennedy budget, you know, deal with her. Compromise on both sides. Everybody gets everything horrible, and nothing horrible is ever sacrificed and stopped. And they did it outright. They did it at the expense of veterans' health care. or veterans' pensions, but still. And I'm not saying that Americans all really owe pensions to veterans, because I'm not really for that. But, you know, all things being equal and in their media narrative way of doing things and whatever. Oh, they'll make sure that they'll spend $50 million on a F-35 that they can't fly at night or in the rain or see out of, even in daylight, and the helmet doesn't work. And if there's a rain, if there's lightning nearby, you can't be near 25 miles away, and damn thing isn't stealthy at all. Not even really faster than an F-16. Better armed than an F-15. Oh, they got all the money in the world to spend on F-35s. But oh, you got your legs blown off out there playing the IED lottery, inflicting the empire on nobodies in the middle of Pashtunistan, huh? Well, cuts for you. Bonuses for Lockheed executives, dividends for their shareholders, and cuts for the foot soldiers. I mean, don't act like you're surprised, but do go ahead and internalize the truth and remember it for later that, you know, these people, they really don't love you. They actually never did. Even if you only found out late, they actually never did love you all along. But there you go. So it's the National Defense Authorization Act. Base funding. $527 billion. It's got to be more than that. They don't have to occupy Iraq anymore, thank God. But they've still got a terrorist war in Syria to fund. On the terrorist side. And so there you go, anyway. This is at the Liberty Crier. And I didn't mean to critique their article at all because I didn't even get a chance to read it. It's just about the costs and what all. But I just wanted to comment on the JPEG there. And the lesson from that. I don't know, man. It seems to me, y'all, like it doesn't have to be this way. Not that it would have to be my way, although my way is always the best way. But it doesn't have to be like this, where the government, the state, just pisses everything away on killing and making new enemies. It's just crazy. It's so much wealth destroyed that could be wealth going straight into the pockets of the people of this country. It's their money. It's our money. You know? And especially, you know, with the criminal central banking system and the horrifying boom and bust that they continue to inflict on the American people, there are a lot of really desperate people here in our own country who are being made all the more desperate as their wealth is being transferred to militarism, to useless militarism. You know, even Gene Kirkpatrick, the neocon darling and Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Soviet, Freudian slip there, to the United Nations. She said, oh, finally, the Soviet Union is gone. The USSR is dissolved. Now we can be a normal country in a normal time. And everybody just, did somebody hear of Geraldine Ferraro say something? Tell her to shut up. Yeah, who the hell is this Jim Kirkpatrick? What is she talking about? Normal country, normal time. You ever see the movie Nixon? And the guy from I Dream of Jeannie plays the mean old Texan who's threatening Nixon. Nixon's going, hey, I'm the president here. And he's going, yeah, who's kidding who, pal? I'll kill you. And he's playing, basically he's playing, you know, Fort Worth Lockheed executive, basically. This is Oliver Stone's portrayal of the Beast, what he calls the Beast. That's not the old establishment, all the bankers. That's the new establishment, the post-World War II military-industrial complex. They're mean sons of bitches. That's a good movie, which I think Oliver Stone likes presidents too much, even Nixon. But anyway. By the way, Oliver Stone is speaking at that FFF thing. That should be good. February the 15th. Did I say that? All right. So I'm taking the rest of the week off. I might be back Friday. I don't know. But anyway, Merry Christmas, and I'll see you around my Facebook page, I guess, / Scott Horton Show and scotthorton.org. Thanks for listening.